Welcome to the Tech and Main Presents podcast with your host, Sean St. Hill. Sean is the CEO of Tech and Main, a technology consulting firm in Atlanta, Georgia. Listen in as thought leaders share their tips and insights about what's going on in the world of technology. And now, here's your host, Sean St. Hill.
Thank you for joining another episode of Tech and Main Presents, where we bring you the best insights from today's leaders and experts in technology. Today, we will be speaking with Brian Smith of Spiderbat. Brian, welcome to the Tech and Main Presents podcast.
Hey, Sean. Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to this. This really fun podcast.
Yes. Thank you so much. Yeah, Brian, look, like I said before we started the podcast, man, this is all about you. We are going to enjoy ourselves. And so with that, tell us a little bit about your background.
Yeah. So my friends call a fallen physicist. I got an undergrad in physics from Berkeley and decided that I like knowing physics than a lot more than I like doing physics. Okay. So I spent a couple of years kind of trying different things. I taught hang gliding for a while and taught other things. Back into computer science. Yeah. There's a timeout.
How does a man with a physics degree in undergrad from UC Berkeley add hang gliding instruction into that story? Oh.
So when I was walking across campus at Berkeley as an undergrad, there's this famous gate called Sproul Plaza, which was sort of the center of the free speech movement in the 1960s. And this gate at the end of the plaza. And there was a hang glider sitting up there in one of those kind of student activity, all the clubs are out.
Okay.
There was a hang gliding club at Berkeley, and we got to talking about that. And it was the coolest club, because what you could do was the club owned gliders, and they teach you how to use them.
Okay.
And so you'd sign up for lessons, and then basically you were allowed to go out and take out the gliders and use them at the sites that they approved them at.
Oh, wow.
And you had to repair them. They teach you how to repair them, but you had to repair them and stuff. And you'd learned how to fly. And so I eventually became sort of a leader in the club. And then eventually I started teaching, and I got my advanced degrees in teaching and taught advanced hang gliding and competed in hang gliding and just did all hang gliding stuff over many, many years. I have about 800 hours in hang gliders.
Okay. So Brian Smith, what's the coolest place you've been able to go hang gliding?
The most memorable one was on the east side of the Sierras. So if you go over the Sierras up, because I was a student at Berkeley, so we were in California.
Right.
So if you go up and over the Sierras rise over about 50, 60 miles. Over about maybe 100 miles over east to west,
okay,
or west to east. And then they drop over about 2 in this spectacular valley called the Owens Valley.
Okay.
So you're driving around in the bottom of the valley there, and you'll see this little kind of lump on the side with a giant mountain range behind it. And the mountain range is like 6 times the height of the little bump. And then you look on the map and you realize that little bump is a 2,000-foot mountain. And wow. The thing behind it is this 10,000-foot cliff, basically, because that's where like Mount Whitney is and stuff.
Okay.
And so just south of Mount Whitney, you can launch out there, and it's an advanced hang gliding site. And you can climb up, ride the thermals and climb up. And you'd spend 3 or 4 days training there, getting to gradually higher and higher altitudes until you could get high enough to cross the valley. So then you'd start on this north trip, because you had to get up to a minimum of 18,000 feet to cross the valley.
Okay.
And so you get up to 19,000, cross the valley, and then head north. And it's this beautiful, spectacular thing. I flew about 100 miles, ended up landing at the border of Nevada at this little airstrip out there that was also a brothel. And it was the only place to land, and it had a phone. So that's where you land. It's called Janie's. But at the very north end of that mountain range, Annual Current Mountain Range, there's this spectacular white peak that's like 3 sides of a pyramid called Boundary Peak. It's about 13,000 feet. And I was circling over there, and a golden eagle came into the center of the thermal with me. And then a sailplane was on the outside of the thermal with me, and the 3 of us were just going up together. And it was so cool. And we were like 13,000, 14,000 feet, so 15,000 feet. And it was really pretty. It was just really, that was a neat, incredible experience. Lots of stories from hang gliding days, but.
Brian Smith, that has to be one of the coolest stories I've ever heard.
Yeah, it was fun. It was really, as you can, very memorable.
Wow. And so, yeah. Thank you for allowing me to go yeah. on that tangent.
Yeah. Back to our regular program.
Yes, back to our regularly scheduled program of learning about your other yeah. the other aspect of your background.
Yeah. So eventually I kind of got into the grad program at Berkeley in the computer science department. Got my PhD there, did my early work on actually video processing.
Okay.
And then started as a professor at Cornell University, did 5 years in the computer science department there. Had always wanted to do a startup and ended up starting a company called Tipping Point with a friend of mine, Mark Wilbeck-Lemaire, and a bunch of other guys. And Tipping Point was a security, back around 2000, was a cybersecurity company that built something called an intrusion prevention system, which basically, if you can imagine taking a wire in a network, cut it in half, plug both ends into this thing, and it kind of scrubs attacks as it goes through. So it detects an attack. And there were all sorts of really interesting technical challenges. That company was sold to 3Com and stayed at 3Com for a while. I became chief architect and CTO of the Tipping Point division of 3Com. And then eventually left that, started another company called Click Security. That was acquired by Alert Logic. And then started Spiderbat back in 2019. It was early 2019 with a bunch of friends that I've acquired along the way. And we sort of start out throughout all these companies. There's one guy, my business partner, Mark Wilbeck-Lemaire, who's kind of been a constant all the way through this. So we've been kind of doing on this little adventure together for 25 years.
Brian, that, okay. And this, I mean, the word that comes to mind is beautiful. And that's not necessarily something that you associate with technology or mm-hmm. InfoSec, but the relationship piece.
Right? Yeah.
That is beautiful.
Yeah, we met when I was a young professor at Cornell, and he had graduated a couple of years before that from Cornell in the ESS department. He was a researcher in video at TJ Watson, at IBM's TJ Watson Research Labs, and he was looking for grad students, and he kind of cold called me because he was looking for grad students for his lab. And we got to know each other and wanted to work together and stuff. So we eventually figured out how to work together.
Oh, that is so amazing. That's been really cool. All right. So Brian,
yeah.
you're there at Spiderbat. What has you most excited about your daily work?
So, I mean, I think in general, what makes me most excited about just working in computer science in general is that there's a lot of things that stay the same, but the technology is always changing. And so you're constantly learning. And kind of, I just feel like I enjoy learning a lot, which is why I spent 25 years in school. It's some people never learn. My dad, when I graduated from Berkeley, said, so you've been in school about 25 years now. Are you about done?
Nope, not yet.
So then, no, I'm off to Cornell. but I think it's that there's this constancy of things that stay the same. A lot of the principles stay the same, but the rules and the parameters that guide those principles change a lot through the years. So back in the 1960s, for example, they had magnetic tape drives and core memory and stuff. So really small memory and these very slow tape drives and things that were the storage systems. And fast forward, we've got flash drives that store 2 gigabytes or a terabyte of multiple terabytes on a flash drive. And so the access times, the amount of data, everything, all those change. And that forces you to revisit all the decisions over and over again. And so you're kind of constantly revisiting the decisions, retweaking the core principles to make stuff work. And I just enjoy building stuff, I think. So it's kind of you think about new designs that all these things enable. And it just changes. It's a slightly different way of looking at things. Mm-hmm. And it allows just a lot of innovation and a lot of new solutions to old problems. And I don't know, it's just a lot of fun. I like building things.
Well, Brian, as I'm listening to you, I think of a very popular artist who has a song that says, haters are going to hate. And I think if you adapt that, builders are going to build.
Yeah, right? Yeah, exactly.
And so it's innate. It's a part of who you are, right? And so I think that's awesome.
Yeah, you see what you're drawn to and what you naturally do, and then if you can find a job that does that, that's really a nice place to be.
Yeah. You've landed in your zone of genius, I think is what they call it. So yeah, that's awesome. All right, so Brian, your clients at Spiderbat, what would you say are some of the major issues facing those clients that are coming to you?
Yeah, I think when you're building, so what we're facing right now is, in terms of the industry a little bit, is we've been moving gradually towards more and more types of virtualization. So we went from essentially computers running in racks and data centers back in the late 1990s, to VMs running, to cloud systems, to containers, and now we have Kubernetes kind of orchestration and kind of the cloud native movement. And all of these things create more and more virtualization and systems that just come and go like crazy. When you're building those systems, one thing that I think keeps on coming up is how do you deal with security in them? Because a lot of my career has been built around cybersecurity issues. And so when you're building them, you can sort of patch them as well as you want, as well as you can. But then the question is there something bad roaming around on my system? Because if you look at these real attacks, they'll get on the system, oftentimes through bugs you don't know about, or some other weakness, or the stolen credentials, or any number of ways to get onto the system. And then they'll be really quiet. And so the approach we've used up to this point is sort of trying to detect bad stuff happening. And so it always leaves this kind of fear of, is something bad happening that my detectors are just not detecting? And that was a vulnerability that I didn't know about. Something bad is happening on my systems. And I'm only going to find out 6 months ago when the FBI calls me and tells me about all my customers' data that has appeared somewhere else. And so those are, I think, a lot of the concerns that pretty much everyone in cybersecurity has, is that I've done everything I can, but there's this sort of nagging feeling of, is there something happening there that I don't know about? And so we've tried to figure out solutions to that problem. And I think it's more about not, is the code correct that I'm building, but at runtime, is it working the way I expect it to, and is nothing bad happening?
Okay. And so, and I think you started to kind of articulate this, the answer to this next question, and that is, how does Spiderbat solve that major issue? How do you bring comfort to that senior leader at a company so that they can sleep well at night?
Yeah. So it's kind of back to what I was talking about earlier, is that the changes in technology oftentimes allow new solutions to old problems. So if you're trying to, a lot of our security solutions were built around securing things like laptops and mobile devices and a lot of bring your own device stuff. And that's largely the wild, wild west. It's just people do all sorts of strange things on these. They install random software. It's just tough to figure out what's going on even on these systems.
Yes.
But instead, if you think about the cloud native world, what we do is we build services that are microservice architectures. So we build, we take a large backend server farm, a Kubernetes cluster or something like that, and you build it up into these little microservices that are talking to each other, and those are built around containers usually. So you run this container and that runs microservice, and usually what that container does is something very, very tight and specific. It will accept requests from some system and talk to a few other systems. So if you imagine like a traditional three-tier web architecture, as a simple example, you'll have a web server, and it's expected to take inbound connections from port 80 or port 443 from the internet, and then it, or some load balancer upstream. And then it's expected to talk to maybe the API server, and the API server is expected to receive connections from one of these web servers and talk to the database layer. And then the database layer knows that it's supposed to only receive connections from the API server. So in a sense, we can constrain exactly what these things do. Okay. So what you can do, what we've done is we've built a system that gives you a lot, can look into those systems and monitor every process, every connection, every file access, everything that's going on these systems, and profile what processes do, what connections, where they accept connections from, and what part of a container does. What this allows you to do is build essentially a fingerprint for every given image that runs. It's what services it takes connections from on what port, what it talks to, what processes are involved in those connections, and so on. And say and make it easy for a developer to understand that. And it does this passively. So then you just kind of run all my fingerprints and merge them together into a baseline. And that becomes, this is what this image should do. And so I look at it as a developer and I install it in and I say, okay, if it ever does anything different, scream at me. And you basically do that for your various services. We build profiles that run over the base system to do the same thing across internal Kubernetes stuff, as well as what's the VMs they run on. And now the whole system, in some sense, is understood that if anything goes outside of those profiles, we get what we call a policy violation. And then we can string together the policy violations to say these things are all together. They're all in the same container. They're all in the same chain of causally connected chain, that this caused this, caused this, caused this. And what that allows you to do is it becomes really hard when you think about it to evade that system. About the only types of attacks that work against that system are things where it's really a bug in the application logic itself. Like something called a SQL injection attack is an example of this, where I can inject some bad data into it and get the application to just do what it would normally do and lose data. But almost every other vulnerability, like the Log4j attack, would immediately get detected and blocked by this without knowing that there's a Log4j vulnerability that exists. Maybe only the bad guys know it, and it's being exploited in some way that no one's ever seen before. It shows up because these applications will start doing something that they've never done before. And that will show up as a change in the profile behavior and hit the profile module and kill it. So it's almost like we can build this white list of this is everything the program's allowed to do and else is suspect. And then on top of that, you build a system that makes it really easy to figure out what the suspect stuff that was doing, what it was actually doing. And that helps you remediate it and figure out.
What's so interesting about that, Brian? You mentioned the Log4j vulnerability.
Right? Yeah. So,
I mean, everyone in our ecosystem knows what that is. But to hear you explain it in such a way that customer, it's almost like you're taking away the excuse, right? Yeah. They don't even know that an excuse is out there.
Yeah.
It's like what you've built helps just keep things at bay.
Yeah. It lets what's going on, and it gives you a tremendous tool in prioritizing what you should do, because it's one thing to try to patch every vulnerability and every theoretical attack that ever could be there. And that's a huge monumental job, but it's really motivating to patch things that are actively being attacked because you'll get on top of that really fast. And it's very targeted, right? So if you have a set of 500 vulnerabilities you got, and these three are actually being exploited, and we have a compensating control that's blocking the attacks, I'll go patch those things. They'll immediately go to the top of my list of things that I want to patch. And if someone comes in with a completely unknown attack that is just a zero-day type of attack, we'll detect it anyway, because it'll just show up as a policy violation. We'll stop it. And then you get to figure out exactly what it is and tell everyone else that about this attack.
Right. But so, again, you've stopped it, and you've kept that client from being a meme or showing yeah. up as, like you said, the FBI contacting you weeks or months later saying, yeah, you've been owned by whoever.
Well, and it's not, the approach is not, I'm trying to detect bad things. And so I'll miss something if because the detector, it wasn't known to the detector of bad things. This is saying, this is what's good. And anything else, let me know about. But a practical way to make that so that it's not constantly false alarming, because that's what would happen in desktops and phones and stuff like that, is it would just, this thing would ring off the hook. But because we have these containerized environments, it becomes practical all of a sudden with the right technology behind it.
Oh, that's good stuff.
Yeah. So that's
all right. So Brian, let me ask you this. For the young person or the person that's young at heart, right? they're in their current career and they are looking to maybe pivot into technology or InfoSec. What advice would you have for that person?
Well, I mean, the first thing is just, is it something you feel relatively passionate about? If you're just trying to get in there because, wow, I've heard there's lots of jobs in tech, but it really bores you, it's just probably not the right place. Because what the key to success in just about anything is being passionate about it and just being drawn to it. If you are drawn to it, then absolutely go for it and just stay curious. Start learning about technologies initially. But then when an opportunity presents itself to learn about something a little more fundamental that might appear on a CS curriculum or something like that, the reason why those curriculums are there, because they're kind of patterns and principles that just keep on occurring over and over. And they've occurred for 50, 60 years in computer science. So I'll give an example. There's an intern who's working for us and he ran into this problem that gave him an opportunity to learn about parsers, things that convert text strings, that the same things that run on compilers run on, okay, that convert text and like programs and allow you to translate them. And so rather than just solving the little tiny problem, spend a day or two learning about LR parsers, teach yourself all about LR parsers, then apply that. And now you've got a great little tool in your toolbox. So just be really curious and look for those opportunities rather than learning little tiny bits of technology, which seems to be a lot of the way our industry is kind of focused on. Look for opportunities to learn the kind of repeatable patterns too. And then they become tools in your toolbox. And then the second thing is just make sure you're passionate about it. And by that I mean that you're drawn to it just naturally. It's the stuff you would do on a Saturday afternoon anyway, just because it's fun. Oh. Unless you are exhausted.
Right. Unless you're coming off, working an 80 or 90 hour work week.
It's, or something.
Yeah. But Brian, you touch on something interesting, and I find this to be so true. Look, if you go on any job board right now and you look up the salary range for a chief information security officer,
yeah,
it's pretty stout, Mr.
Yeah,
pretty stout, yep. Right? I mean, you're talking a couple hundred thousand dollars at least.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, if you're looking at it just because of the salary range, then yeah, you're probably not going to last very long.
Yeah.
All right. Let's push pause for just a moment because we're at 2:30, and I want to be super respectful of your time. So
I'm okay.
You're good.
This is good.
Okay. Awesome. All right. So, we'll pick back up from there. So
yeah.
So Brian, I appreciate you sharing that insight because I think one of the things that we often find people, if they're looking to pivot into a technology or InfoSec career,
yeah,
they're looking at it from two numbers primarily, right? It's mm-hmm. one, the number of open requisitions that are out there, right? Which,
yeah,
depending on who you talk to, are in the thousands or millions.
Yeah. Right?
But then the second number they're looking at is, hey, I can become a SOC analyst or I can become a chief information security officer and make hundreds of thousands of dollars, mm-hmm. right? But if you have zero passion or zero real interest in putting together a security program that's based on NIST or CIS 20,
yeah,
then you're not gonna you're not going to do too well.
Yeah, it's, I mean, if you will naturally succeed if you're doing something that you're passionate about and that you have some skill in. Right. So I could be yes. passionate about singing, but I have a lousy voice. So then it's a hobby. Right. Right. But if you have some skill in singing and you're passionate about it, then good things are going to happen. Because you're going to just keep on plugging at it and doing it. And opportunities are what is Yogi Berra was at least said to have said, luck is when preparation meets opportunity.
Yes.
Yeah. So,
I think that's the other part of the equation, right? That skill component. Yeah. You think about athletes. I mean, at the time of this recording, it's the day after the Super Bowl, right?
Exactly.
And so you think of the two teams that participated in the Super Bowl, and you realize that all 53 athletes on either side put in a tremendous amount of work, but there's also a tremendous amount of skill.
And they would not have put in that work unless they felt just passionate about the game. It's just stuff they would do on their own, right?
Exactly. I mean, and for some of them, I mean, they've been playing since they were 6, 7 years old.
Yeah. And it doesn't mean that it's a 24/7 thing for them, for any of us, right? We all need recharge time, but it is something that just, that calls to you, that draws you into it, that you want to do on your, and so that's something you want to look for, where that intersection of skill and passion.
Yeah, absolutely. Couldn't agree
more. And it's something that society cares about, you know, to do, because I could be passionate about the why sea urchins don't have spots, but then it's a hobby.
Right. Yeah, we're going back to the hobby. Good point, Ryan. Good point. All right, so let's ask this next series of questions, and the first one being, name your favorite musician or band.
Yeah, so that one's that actually is a little bit of a tough one for me, because I don't actually have so much musicians or bands that called me, but songs.
Okay.
Songs are, to me, are music is this giant amplifier of emotion. If you're feeling it, if you're feeling that emotion, like the sad love song, if you're in a happy mood, the sad love song doesn't, it's just kind of annoying. But if you're like just getting over a breakup or something, it's like, it's this amplifier and this kind of confirmation of your emotions. And so the ones that, my favorite song of all time is Wonderful World by Louis Armstrong.
Okay.
Simply because it's so optimistic, and I listen to the words and it makes me feel very just kind of grateful for the world we live in and for the things of the aspects of the world. So there's songs that make me really happy and amplify those emotions are the ones. So that would probably be my favorite is Louis B. Armstrong's Wonderful World. But there's a bunch of those.
Like okay. That. Oh, I think that is certainly a classic. And I can think of some of the songs that I initially downloaded on my iPod. You're dating myself, right? And it's still a part of the iTunes catalog. But yeah, that was definitely one of them.
Yeah, I got into all sorts of things from that era, but then just from the 90s, just all over the place, because music, those themes transcend time and musicians and place. They're just that ones that speak to you.
Yeah, very well said, Mr. Smith. Very well said, sir. How about a favorite hobby or pastime?
That's a good question. Well, I told you for a while it was hang gliding, but yes. These days, I have two kids, and my youngest got into tennis about nine years ago and went pretty far in it. So that about 3 or 4 years ago, I started trying to take tennis lessons just so that I could spend time with him doing that. And it's gotten into that now myself. So I'm playing tennis and or doing lessons or doing wall drills or drills or matches or tournaments or different things, probably about 5, 6 days a week now. So that's it's a wonderful group of people, and it's something that I see people out there that are 70 years old. There's a guy told me this story. He said in Palm Springs there was an over 60s league, and so I thought that was pretty cool. But it got too crowded, so they've been in an over 70s league, and then that got too crowded, so there was an over 80s league, and then that got too crowded, so there's an over 90s tennis league.
No way.
They have a whole freaking league of over 90s. And it just shows you that it really is a lifetime kind of sport. It's so healthy.
Brian Smith, there's a league of 90-year-old people playing tennis.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing?
That is amazing.
It's just so cool.
No, it really is. And look, all right, so here's another tangent, right? We talk about now notice you didn't say that there was a massive amount of money that had to be invested in this machine that was going to keep these people alive until they were 90. No, this is what we have in our garage, man. A tennis racket and some tennis balls.
Yeah. Public courts, go
and
out.
A couple of courts.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, this didn't take an act of Congress, right, to allocate a bunch of money. This is literally, I mean, I'm dead serious. We have in the garage right now two tennis rackets and, I mean, balls. I mean, containers of tennis balls. So, wow.
Yeah, my wife actually is on a soccer team, on a couple soccer teams, but her hero was this woman who was a goalie out there, and she was celebrating her 70th birthday.
Oh, wow.
The whole teams got together and sang her happy birthday on her 70th birthday. I thought that was just such a cool image.
Oh, Brian, I love that, man. That is that's a blessing.
Yeah. No, that's
awesome. is so groovy. Yeah. Man, Brian, you got me over here in Atlanta feeling good, man.
Right, good for a day.
Yes, that is the best thing I've heard all day.
Cool.
Yeah.
So
So thank you for that. All right, Brian, what's a favorite place for you to take the family on vacation?
So we do a lot of, because of my background, we tend to orient our vacations around activities.
Okay.
And so the best one I've ever done, it was a rafting trip down the Grand Canyon. So it's something my wife and I did when 25 years ago, and we were waiting until the kids got old enough, because you have to be at least 12 to do this. So when my youngest turned 12, that the first summer that we could, we went rafting down the Grand Canyon, and it was we went with my wife's mother, so my mother-in-law, who was 82 years old, and she's rafting down the Grand Canyon, this big water, serious rafting. They could do class 1 through class 5 for the normal rapids. This big water rafting, they do it on a 10 scale, because it's the water is very different, just because of the size of the waves and stuff. You'll get 30-foot waves out there. Oh, wow. So you'll get just these really powerful rapids. But she's going down the rapids there. And my older son and I did the full 15-day trip down. And you're camping every night out under the stars on beaches. And the guides are taking care of you. My mother-in-law, though, heroic thing, stopped at halfway down at Phantom Ranch and backpacked with her backpack 5,000-foot ascent in August in Arizona at 81 years old, which is just insane. She broke like the previous record for that company by like 10 years.
Okay.
Some really hardiness there.
I was going to say, look, your kids come from some hardy stock.
But that was, I mean, like, she's a bit of a hero too. But anyway, if you ever get the chance to do something like that, if you like camping outdoors and just being outdoors, it's totally glamping, because basically you roll up on the beach and you have to lay out a pad and set up a tent, and that's about it. They take your breakfast, lunch, dinner, and you can carry a mountain of crap on one of these big 18-foot rafts.
Oh, Brian, that sounds life-changing.
Yeah, it really was. It was, it's really neat. And rather than kind of going to the edge of the Grand Canyon and looking down and saying, wow, really big, you're kind of going through it layer by layer. And so it evolves very gradually and naturally. And so you learn a lot about it. And there's all these side hikes up the canyons, and it's just, it's paradise. And the other great thing about it is you're with like 15 other people, and everyone is them their best selves, because you form like this little tribe that's looking after each other, and everyone's on vacation. So they're all de-stressed and stuff like this. And you just, the people turn into these wonderful people. You make friends that last a really long time. It's like forming a new family by the time you end the trip. It's really, really cool.
Oh, that is so cool.
Yeah, Ryan, it's a fun.
You're sharing some amazing things, Ryan.
Yeah, it's been fun.
there was that commercial from a few years back. Was it the world's most interesting man? Dos Equis commercial.
Yeah. Ryan Smith, Lifetime Achievement Awards.
Look, bro, I am here to tell you that guy has nothing on you. I mean, from the hang gliding to the going down the rapids of the Grand Canyon. Yeah.
Just lots of experiences in this world.
and Brian, honestly, that's what life is about, right?
Totally.
I mean, look, work hard, heck yeah. Mm-hmm. And don't let up off the pedal, right? Yeah. Like, go hard. But there is a time where, okay, we've completed the project, launched the product, what have you. Okay, mission accomplished, right? We celebrate the win, but then exactly we unplug, we de-stress, and we go enjoy life and those that mean the most to us.
Absolutely. Yep.
That's good stuff. All right, Brian, what teacher at any level has had the greatest impact on you?
So there was a guy, there's sort of one obvious winner. The guy who's had absolutely the most impact on my life is a guy, Professor Larry Rowe, who was a professor at UC Berkeley. And I met him, I told you I was doing this kind of hang gliding stuff when I was undergrad. And I was working actually in the Department of Architecture, oddly enough, doing a bunch of computer stuff for them, doing custom code development. Long story there. But we were trying to get a grant, applying for a federal grant from, or a grant, I think it was from the Annenberg Foundation. And he came over and joined us on the graph to kind of do the CS gravitas. And he saw me and saw what I was doing. And he offered me a job in the CS department at Berkeley as essentially a researcher. Okay. Over there but really programming on his research projects. I opened my eyes to just computer science in general. And so there were all these conversations happening in the hall that I couldn't follow because they were just using words and concepts that I didn't understand. And so I wanted to get back into grad school. I wanted to go to grad school and took all the tests and did all the things. But getting into grad school at Berkeley is really tough. There were 5,000 applicants and 65 admitted.
Oh, geez.
So he happened to be, advised me into that position and helped me figure out how to do that. It was got there by the skin of my teeth, but I got there and then worked with him, and he was my PhD advisor through it and just kind of opened my eyes to all of this. You look through the years and you see all of these people who helped you out, and you, a lot of times when you're young, you don't even realize what they're doing for you, and then you're just, as you get older, you get really thankful for them.
Yeah, perspective, Brian.
Yeah. So anyway, he was definitely the winner of that. Okay. The most influential award.
No, Professor Rowe, that's, yeah, shout out to Professor Rowe. I like that.
Yeah.
And Brian, we've come to our last question, and I will unashamedly say it is my favorite, but it's where we go back in the time machine and we get to ask the Brian Smith of today to give his 18-year-old self some advice, what would it be?
Yeah, at the time when I was 18, I mean, there's all sorts of things about your 18-year-old self that you probably cringe at. We all do.
This is true, sir. This is true.
But the one for me that I think that I wasn't careful enough about and didn't think enough about was just being relationships as they go along, because you meet people as you're going along and build good friendships of the moment while you're there. But then when I drift away and go off to do something else, we all do in life, we think Absolutely. Things end, the new things start. I wasn't good about staying in touch with those people and just nurturing those relationships. And like, I don't think I understood at the time that relationships, kind of like all things, take some amount of effort, some amount of deliberateness to them. And I would spend more time keeping track of those relationships and stuff. As I've gotten older and gotten more into business, I've realized just how important a lot of those things are. And I do have a lot of really good relationships, but I've also have so many that I look in the past where I just fell out of touch with people. And it was just because I wasn't disciplined about, deliberate about maintaining them.
No, I think
they weren't either. So, but anyway, that would be my advice to myself, is be a little bit more deliberate about that one thing.
Well, you talked earlier about your business partner, Mark, right?
Yeah.
And so I think, and this is just my assessment, but clearly you've learned the lesson, so to speak, right?
Mostly, yeah. I mean, there's a limited number of relationships that any person can handle, but...
Absolutely.
But yeah, no, it's Mark's been a really good friend through the years.
Oh, that's awesome. All right, Brian Smith, to say that I have enjoyed this would be an understatement. You are interesting, easy to talk to, just an all-around good egg, and I can't thank you enough for being on the podcast.
Well, thank you. I've really enjoyed the conversation, and you just have a personality that draws that out of people, which is probably why you're successful at what you do.
Oh, well, thanks, Brian. I appreciate that. Before we go, what is the best way for people to connect with you?
The easiest way to connect, it is actually, it's going to sound weird, but actually through Spiderbat. It's such a small company right now. We're 20 people at this point. So it's a startup company, just like startup. And there's a community Slack channel we have associated with it. And I'm just on there all the time. So that's probably the easiest way, is direct messaging. I mean, the usual things, LinkedIn and so on. But definitely, if you go to Spiderbat, just kind of check it out. And there's a community Slack channel. That's the easiest way to get a hold of me, because that's where I'm at every day.
All right. Well, we'll definitely put that information in the show notes. But again, Brian, I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your day to be with us.
Yeah. Thank you, Sean. Thanks for the opportunity. It's been fun.
Yeah, it has been. And Tech and Main Presents family, thank you as always for listening. And be sure to tune in next time when we will have another technology expert share their wisdom. Goodbye for now.
You've been listening to another episode of Tech and Main Presents. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. Don't forget to tell your friends. And thanks for being a part of the Tech and Main Presents community.